Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook paper and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. So throughout our entire analysis of the web of debt, we see that in fact Congress and the Fed may have unleashed an era of greed. There is, however, the U.S. court system, which can still act as a referee. Among other daunting challenges facing the banks today is that if and when the curtain is lifted on their derivative schemes, the defrauded investors will turn around and sue. The hot potato of liability the banks thought they had pitched to the investors will be tossed back to the banks. In an article in the San Francisco Chronicle in 2007, attorney Sean Ollander suggested that this was the real reason for the subprime bailout schemes being proposed by the U.S. Treasury Department, not to keep strapped borrowers in their homes, but to stave off a spate of lawsuits against the banks. One proposal was the creation of a new superfund that would buy risky mortgage bonds, concealing how little those bonds were actually worth. When the plan was abandoned, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson proposed an interest rate freeze on a limited number of subprime loans. Ollander wrote, quote, "The sole goal of the freeze is to prevent owners of the mortgage-backed securities, many of them foreigners, from suing U.S. banks and forcing them to buy back worthless mortgage securities at face value, right now almost 10 times their market worth." The ticking time bomb in the U.S. banking system is not resetting subprime mortgage rates. The real problem is the contractual ability of investors in mortgage bonds to require banks to buy back the loans at face value if there was fraud in the origination process. The catastrophic consequences of bond investors forcing originators to buy back loans at face value are beyond the current media discussion. The loans at issue dwarf the capital available at the largest U.S. banks combined, and investor lawsuits would raise stunning liability sufficient to cause even the largest U.S. banks to fail, resulting in massive taxpayer-funded bailouts of Fannie and Freddie and even FDIC. What would be prudent and logical is for the banks that sold this toxic waste to buy it back and for a lot of people to go to prison. If they knew about the fraud, they should have to buy the bonds back. Close quote. Such a thought could send a chill through even the most powerful of investment bankers, including Henry Paulson himself. Oleander noted that Paulson headed Goldman Sachs during the heyday of toxic subprime paper writing from 2004 to 2006. Mortgage fraud was not limited to representations made to borrowers or by borrowers or in loan documents. It was in the design of the bank's financial products themselves. One design flaw was that the credit default swaps used to insure against loan default contained no guarantee that the counterparties had the money to pay up. Another flaw was securitized mortgage debt was made so complex that it was very hard to trace who owned the underlying mortgages in a typical mortgage pool, and without a legal signatory to the note or a valid assignment, there was no one with standing to foreclose on the collateral. That was the procedural problem prompting Federal District Judge Christopher Boyko to rule in October of 2007 that Deutsche Bank did not have standing to foreclose on 14 mortgage loans held in trust for a pool of mortgage-backed securities. The pool lacked standing because it was nowhere named in the documents conveying title. It was proposed that if a large number of defaulting homeowners were to contest their foreclosures on the ground that the plaintiff lacked standing to sue, literally trillions of dollars in mortgage-backed securities could have been at risk. Irate securities holders would respond with litigation that could well threaten the existence of the banking Goliaths. A behind-the-scenes bailout would be hard to engineer in those circumstances, since investor lawsuits are not easily hidden behind closed doors. Unfortunately, since then, the system itself has found ways to get around the no-standing issue in most foreclosure cases. In short, we see how the system that governs us, unfortunately, does bend to the pressure of the banking powers. But there's always hope. The banks are facing legal battles on another front. Disgruntled local officials started taking them to court. A harbinger of things to come was at a first-of-its-kind lawsuit filed in 2008 by Cleveland Mayor Frank Jackson against 21 major investment banks for enabling the subprime lending and foreclosure crisis in his city. City officials said they hoped to recover hundreds of millions of dollars in damages from the banks, including lost taxes from devalued property and money spent demolishing and boarding up thousands of abandoned houses. And I'll come back to this in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. In the Cleveland case, the defendants included banking giants Deutsche Bank, Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, and Citigroup. They were charged with creating a public nuisance by irresponsibly buying and selling high-interest home loans, causing widespread defaults that depleted the city's tax base and left neighborhoods in ruins. Jackson told the Cleveland newspaper The Plain Dealer, quote, "To me, this is no different than organized crime or drugs. It has the same effect as drug activity in neighborhoods. It's a form of organized crime that happens to be legal in many respects." He added in a videotaped interview, "This lawsuit said, you're not going to do this anymore." The newspaper, The Plain Dealer, also interviewed Ohio Attorney General Mark Dan, who was considering a state lawsuit against some of the same banks. "There's clearly been a wrong," he said, "and the source is Wall Street. I'm glad to have some company on my hunt." The Cleveland lawsuit followed another the same week, in which the city of Baltimore sued Wells Fargo Bank for damages from the subprime debacle. The Baltimore suit alleged that Wells Fargo had intentionally discriminated in selling high-interest mortgages more frequently to blacks than to whites in violation of federal law. But the innovative Cleveland suit took much wider aim, targeting the investment banks that fed off the mortgage market by buying subprime mortgages from lenders and then securitizing them and selling them to investors. On February 1, 2008, the state of Massachusetts filed another sort of lawsuit against a major investment bank. The complaint was for fraud and misrepresentation concerning about $14 million worth of subprime securities sold to the city of Springfield by Merrill Lynch. The complaint focused on the sale of certain esoteric financial instruments known as collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, which were unsuitable for the city and which, within months after the sale, became illiquid and lost almost all of their market value. The suit was further precedent for legal relief for defrauded investors. The credit freeze and loss of Monoline's AAA ratings have been crushing to state and local governments, which are now faced with exorbitant interest rates that can make the cost of vital projects prohibitive. One proposed solution is for states to create their own credit. Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution says that states shall not emit bills of credit, something that has been interpreted to mean they cannot issue their own paper money. But there is no rule against a state owning a bank that creates money with accounting entries on accepted fractional reserve banking principles. That option was the basis of an innovative bill called the Minnesota Transportation Act, MTA, which was heard in the Minnesota legislature in 2008. Drafted by Minnesota resident Brian Dale, the bill mandates state-chartered banks to advance funds for approved transportation projects in the same way that they make commercial loans, by simply monetizing the collateral or turning it into money. Banks routinely monetize the promissory notes of borrowers just by making book entries to a checking account and saying, "You have a new deposit with us." Under the MTA, state-chartered banks would create an asset monetization account that would monetize the bid value of projects, turning them into money. This money would not have to be repaid, but would be considered one of those investments the banks are allowed to make with their own excess reserves. It was a clever plan, but the Minnesota legislators rejected it. They said, "Our banks don't create money." So again, this is the basic challenge that we have facing the entire governmental system. They either do not understand the process of banking economics, or even worse, they are a lobbied member of the thinking that supports the current process. A website devoted to the MTA, for example, countered with some authoritative quotes. "The actual creation of money always involves the extension of credit by private commercial banks," end quote. That was Russell Monk, Assistant General Counsel, Department of the Treasury. Then also, quote, "Money is created when loans are issued and debts ignored. Money is extinguished when loans are repaid." John B. Henderson, Senior Specialist in Price Economics, the Congressional Research Service. Another quote, "The money that one borrower uses to pay interest on a loan has been created somewhere else in the economy by another loan." And that was John M. Yetter, Attorney Advisor, Department of the Treasury. Meanwhile, something that might get more traction because it is closer to conventional banking practice is for a state to own its own bank. The bank could then use standard fractional reserve banking principles to create credit on its books, leveraging its deposit base into loans, as all banks do. Publicly owned banks are common in India, Switzerland, Canada, and other countries where they peacefully coexist alongside privately owned banks. The colony of Pennsylvania pioneered this approach in the United States, but today only one state owns its own bank, North Dakota. The Bank of North Dakota was formed in 1919 specifically to free farmers and small businessmen from the clutches of out-of-state bankers and railroad men. The BND's stated mission is to deliver sound financial services that promote agriculture, commerce, and industry in North Dakota. By law, the state must deposit all its funds in the bank. The bank's earnings belong to the state, and their use is at the discretion of the state legislature. The BND is set up as a DBA, the State of North Dakota doing business as the Bank of North Dakota. Technically, that makes the capital of the state the capital of the bank. The BND's return on equity is about 25%. It pays a hefty dividend to the state, projected at over $60 million in 2009. In the last decade, the BND has turned back $0.33 billion to the state's general fund, offsetting taxes. As an agent of the state, the BND can make subsidized loans to spur economic and agricultural development, and it is more lenient than other banks in pressing foreclosures. It avoids friction with private North Dakota banks by partnering with them to loan money to farmers, real estate developers, small businesses, and schools. The BND maintains a robust student loan business and is one of the nation's leading banks in the number of student loans issued. It also purchases municipal bonds from public institutions and operates as the state's mini-Fed, clearing checks for more than 100 banks around the state. It is not part of the FDIC system, but is self-insured by the state. North Dakota remains fiscally sound when other state governments are swimming in red ink. As of 2009, it was one of only two states, along with Montana, able to meet their budgets. In fact, it touted the largest budget surplus it ever had, and it had the lowest unemployment rate in the country. The state's fiscal track record is particularly impressive, considering that its economy consists largely of isolated farms in an inhospitable climate. Ready, low-interest credit from its own state-owned bank helps explain this unusual success. If you're just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So let's just have a brief review of the Wall Street collapse and bailout of 2008, and the global developments of 2009. And before I get started, I just want to say the creativity, genius, and manipulation of those creating the problems and using sleight of hands to distract us are continual and still inflate the bubble. So in March of 2008, Bear Stearns Investment Bank hovered near bankruptcy after heavy short selling. The Federal Reserve advanced $25 billion to Bear Stearns and a further $30 billion to its rescuer, J.P. Morgan Chase, allegedly to prevent a domino-like collapse of the massive derivative scheme in which Bear Stearns was heavily involved. The money all wound up in the coffers of J.P. Morgan Chase, which acquired its rival in a hostile takeover for pennies on the dollar. On September 7, 2008, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson put Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac into a conservatorship, a form of bankruptcy, and agreed to guarantee its $5.4 trillion in loans. The creditors were saved, but the common shareholders were wiped out. This bailout, too, was said to be necessary to keep the massive derivative pyramid from collapsing. On September 16 of 2008, the Federal Reserve took the unprecedented step of buying American International Group, AIG, the world's largest insurance company. The Fed extended an $85 billion loan in exchange for an 80% stake in the insurer. This, too, was supposedly done to prevent a massive derivative collapse. the same weekend, Lehman Brothers went bankrupt after massive naked short selling. Like Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers was heavily invested in derivatives, but in this case, both the Treasury and the Fed declined to bail out the bankrupt bank. The death blow was dealt by J.P. Morgan, which froze $17 billion in excess assets it was holding for Lehman Brothers. The dramatic effect this bankruptcy had on the market was described by Representative Paul Kanjorski in a February 2009 C-SPAN interview. He said Congress was told behind closed doors that following the bankruptcy, a $550 billion run on the money markets had occurred in the space of 2 or 3 hours. Later, commentators said that the run might have been prevented by a managed bankruptcy of the sort subsequently imposed on General Motors, but no such precautions were taken. Why? One cynical commentator used the analogy of the hostage the kidnappers shot to prove they mean business. The veiled message was, "This is what will happen if you let any of our Wall Street banks go bankrupt." On October 3rd, a panicked Congress approved a $700 billion bailout scheme for the banks. The initial plan was for the Treasury to print U.S. securities and trade these debt instruments for the toxic, unmarketable collateral on the bank's books in order to restore the bank's capital base so credit could flow again. The government would get the bad collateral and would have to pay interest to the banks for the privilege, since the banks would wind up holding good interest-bearing U.S. bonds. But the banks were not required to use the bailout money to make commercial loans, so the bailout would not necessarily unfreeze credit in the economy. And while it was an enormous outlay for the taxpayers, even $700 billion was not enough to unwind an estimated $60 trillion in credit default swaps on the books of the U.S. banks. The market responded with a 2,000-point drop in the Dow, in the worst week in the stock market since the Great Depression. Treasury Secretary Paulson then switched to Plan B, nationalizing the banks, following the lead of certain European central banks that had balked at his plan to impose private bank losses on the public. The U.S. Treasury bought equity in 9 selected banks, but unlike in the European nationalizations, control did not pass to the government. And again, there was no written requirement that the funds be used to make consumer loans. J.P. Morgan Chase revealed in a conference call that it would probably use its $25 billion allotment for mergers and acquisitions, buying up other banks, while Citibank was reported to be using its allotment to gamble in the derivatives market. One blogger suggested Gamblers Anonymous for the whole industry. Meanwhile, investment banks Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch were also teetering on insolvency. Less than a week after the AIG bailout, they were transformed overnight into bank holding companies, making them eligible not only for federal bailout money, but to borrow from the Fed at interest rates that soon sank to 0%. This money could be used to buy government bonds at 2 or 3%, a tidy, risk-free cash cow at taxpayers' expense, or it could be used for proprietary trading, speculating for the bank's own account, siphoning profits from ordinary investors who lacked the sophisticated high-frequency trading programs of these professional gamblers. Since the banks had failed to use their bailout money to make commercial loans, on October 14th, the Fed announced that it would open its own lending window to commercial businesses for their short-term operational needs. By the end of November, bailout-related loans, commitments, and guarantees of the Treasury and the Fed were reported to be $8.5 trillion. But where this money was to come from and under what terms it would be advanced remained a mystery. The Fed declined to respond to Freedom of Information Act requests. Clues to the source of the funds came in January of 2009, when the Federal Reserve reported that its assets had increased to $2.1 trillion, an increase of $1.2 $2 trillion from an earlier year. The Fed's liabilities also went up by $1.2 trillion, indicating that it was, like usual, conjuring money simply by double-entry bookkeeping, entering loans as assets on one side of its books and as liabilities on the other. This is how commercial banks routinely come up with the money they lend, but it was an unusual move for the Fed, which has generally restricted its monetizing of debt to the purchase of only enough government securities to provide the liquidity for banks to cash and clear checks. The Fed was now making commercial loans, and it was doing this in enormous quantities. On March 18, 2009, the Fed said that it would be buying as much as $300 billion in long-term government bonds. The announcement raised eyebrows, but borrowing from the government's own central bank allowed Congress to avoid going hat in hand to foreign lenders at a time when foreign central banks were becoming less willing and less able to fund the burgeoning U.S. federal debt. As financial analyst Ben Geisen pointed out, the move also had the advantage that the money was nearly interest-free. Ever since Wright Patman agitated to nationalize the Fed in the 1960s, the Fed had turned over its earnings to the Treasury after deducting its costs. In 2008, the Fed rebated 85% of the interest it received to the government. Critics charged that the Fed was on the high road to hyperinflation, but in 2009, the real threat was not hyperinflation, but deflation. According to the Fed's flow of funds report, credit shrank in the first quarter of 2009 faster than at any other time in history. And when credit collapses, the money supply collapses, since all of the money except coins is now borrowed into existence. Public debt also increased by an unprecedented sum in 2009, but the Fed's monetization of government debt could not keep up with the collapse in private credit. The net result was a significant reduction in loans and thus in the money supply. Although the federal debt was up to $12.3 trillion by the end of 2009, the interest paid on it, $383 billion, was actually less than in 2006, $406 billion, because interest rates had been dropped by the Fed to extremely low levels. Much more transpired in 2009, including troubling moves toward a global currency and banker-controlled global regulator based in Europe. But those developments will have to wait until the future to talk about. In short, our financial woes are a direct result of a monetary scheme in which money is created by private banks and lent into the economy at interest. To find a way out of the labyrinth, we need to retrace our steps and exit on the road by which we came. The power to create the nation's money and credit needs to be vested in the people themselves, as it was in the early American colonies. And we will continue the saga in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.